From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. At the close of a week that saw Senate hearings where accusations of Russia hacking the U.S. election were repeated and amplified, although there's been absolutely no evidence released as of yet of any such efforts by Russia to interfere with the U.S. elections, and as a joint session of Congress meets to take up the Electoral College vote for president, and while the president-elect, Donald Trump, was in conference with the heads of all U.S. intelligence agencies, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero to discuss the many moving parts and perhaps even understand what it all means.
I think that the attempt to delegitimize the Trump presidency before it even gets started is disintegrating. And there is a split in the Senate, and it's not Democrat and Republican. It's Democrats in the main, some Republicans. But then among Democrats, there's a split between people like Chuck Schumer and people like Bernie Sanders. And Bernie Sanders is saying that rather than all this talk about hacking and an election that wasn't legitimate and all of this Russian hating, we need to get on with the business of protecting Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, and addressing all of those issues of the working class and lower middle class that led to the election of Donald Trump in the first place, or the ignominious defeat of the Democrats in 2016 in the first place. So you get this split between the politicians who want to delegitimate Trump and those who realize that that's a dangerous course both for the Democratic Party going forward and for world peace going forward, and are saying that let's address working class issues like Trump did and Bernie Sanders did in 2016, and let's rebuild the Democratic Party based upon regaining or gaining the faith of the working class in this party as something other than what it has been since the time of Bill Clinton, a neoliberal Wall Street Pentagon instrument of their interests, which comes to the American people every 4 or every 2 years trying to say the opposite. The people expressed their rejection of the duplicity of the duopoly, if you want to put it that way, in general, and of the Democratic Party in particular. And Bernie Sanders is saying something very different than the Chuck Schumers and Dianne Feinstein and other corporate Democrats, including Barack Obama.
You know, that raises an interesting point, or point of concern for me in particular, which is, given that this election, and this election wasn't just a defeat for the Democrats, it was a rout. You know, the presidential popular vote notwithstanding, looking at both houses of Congress and state legislatures across the country, the Democrats lost ground and across the board. Mm-hmm. And those that are talking about rebuilding the party must understand, Sanders certainly does, that Trump won because he spoke to the concerns of working people. Whether he's really going to do anything for them or not isn't the point in terms of the politics of it. He said things that people said, yep, that's what I want. And those things revolve around their ability to have a job, make a living, have health care, have mm-hmm. their kids get an education without burdening them with debt, you know, that kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. rather than, and Sanders is counseling mm-hmm. that they go there. And yet the leadership of the party, you know, across the board seems to want to go to this neo-McCarthyism instead, to the hostility towards Russia. I mean, they're still playing with troops on the borders. They've actually stepped up their activities over the past few days. So is this because they just can't shift gears because they're locked into a political mindset, or are they going to pursue this? This is the part that troubles me. Or does this mean they're just going to pursue this policy to its end, regardless of who takes office on the 20th, if they wait that long?
Well, you know, they're faced with an existential crisis. I know I've used that phrase over and over and over again, but it is just that. It is a loss of confidence and legitimacy at home among voters. And this is going on across Western Europe, by the way, everywhere from England and Brexit to Italy, to Greece, and now possibly France. So domestic turmoil politically, the old neoliberal managerial elite and those that they serve, by which I mean Wall Street and the Pentagon, losing their authority to rule. One of those crises where they cannot rule in the old way. And that's what the Trump election represented. That's what Brexit represented. Above whatever you think of the individuals, the specifics, in its broad outlines, it is working people, perhaps not all of them. Of course, in all of the major capitalist countries, the working classes are divided. And that's part of the reason that the elites, the bankers, the industrialists have ruled for so long, because the working class is divided. That's not a new story. But the fact is, enough of them became the engine of this rejection of the old style rule. We come and say to you on election what you want to hear. But then when we govern, we do the exact opposite. So that is a domestic political crisis of unprecedented dimensions. The other thing is the crisis of empire, the crisis of imperialism as a world system. The post World War II, Western-dominated imperialist system is predicated upon a European Union, an Atlantic Alliance, which is connected to the European Union, but not the same as the European Union. That is why England never joined the Eurozone. It was connected to both. That is the United States and Europe. It was, London is, was a central financial center connected to and at times in competition with Wall Street. But definitely this European Union, which, or Western unity, which was held up primarily by the economic might of the United States and the global power of the dollar as the major trading currency in the world. Then there is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which targeted the Soviet Union, but now has become a world force, a gendarme, if you will, to put down any forms of democratic struggle or any struggles that challenge Western hegemony. The dollar is declining as the major global currency. It is being challenged in particular by the renminbi. So on and on, this disintegration of this global imperialist system, which was established after World War II. And I would just like to indicate that although commentators do not use the word neocolonialism any longer, referring to emerging markets and that type of thing. But the system of domination was predicated upon a new order after the decolonization process of the 1940s to the 1970s, for the most part, a new order of neocolonialism, of economic and financial domination. And when that was not adequate, the use of the big stick of coup d'etats, of assassinations, and on and on and on. Well, the neocolonial system that operates in much of Asia, almost all of Africa, a good part of South America and the Caribbean, that system is in crisis. And probably the most dramatic expression of that are the moves being made by the current Philippine government to realign itself away from the United States military alliance and trading alliances towards China and, by implication, Russia. This is huge. I would suggest one other part of this in Asia, and that is probably the possibility of the reorientation of South Korea away from the U.S. military and economic umbrella towards China and a more natural relationship with Asia. Now, of course, if South Korea reorients its relationships in Asia, that opens the door towards a demilitarization of the Korean Peninsula. And as is the case in the Philippines, the demand that U.S. troops leave South Korea.
You know, one of the things that interests me about that is, you know, South Korea has been willing to play along with the United States, although it's not like it was really offered much of a choice with the occupation of the country by the U.S. military, but it's pinned its hopes for Korea wants to be unified as an underlying dynamic. It's just natural. And the hope of reunification with the North, the South had believed, people were, you know, believing that the U.S. held the key to that over time. The U.S. would, you know, force a collapse of the North, and then there would be a unification. You know, and I'm assuming what happened in, you know, the late 1980s, like in 1989 in Germany, that reified that idea for people. But, you know, now it's pretty clear that China holds the key to the reunification of Korea. And I'm wondering if there's been a shift in the mindset, or perhaps underway, a shift in the mindset in the elite in South Korea on that point.
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, I think there's been a shift in the mindset of the masses of South Korea, which we see, you know, which is hardly reported here, in these general strikes. I think there are several in 2016. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the current political crisis, which goes far beyond a corruption scandal and impeachment of the current sitting president. I think it gets to the very heart of a loss of confidence among the Korean people and growing sections of the elite with this warfare footing of the South Korean nation, which of course drains resources from the economy and impoverishes the South Korean people. War is the enemy of the masses of South Korea. The U.S. occupation is an enemy of the prosperity of South Korea. Now, of course, with the collapse of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the whole pivot to Asia of the Obama administration, and I should say that has collapsed, it has opened the door to a new, and let's understand this, I'm not using this term in the way the Japanese imperialists use it in the 1940s, but a new prosperity zone, which connects naturally, the economies of Asia or a large part of Asia in a natural way as neighbors based upon not being anti-anybody but pro-development. And of course, when you connect these developments to the new strategic alliance between China and Russia, and then the whole thing of the new Silk Road right. of China and these railroads. I mean, we're looking at a different world, and essentially the collapse of the old, well, I'm saying old, the 70-some-year-old global military, financial, and economic and trading alliances developed with the U.S. at the center after World War II. I would just like to add one other thing. The crisis of Saudi Arabia and the Saudi Arabian ruling class, they are on thin ice. And I think that if Turkey continues the trajectory that I think it's on, that is away from the West towards Russia and China, and as Erdogan said about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, they were considering joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is the really military and military alliance based upon China and Russia. I mean, I think we're looking at some fundamental changes in the world order.
You know, looking at the objective conditions, for example, you know, you describe railroads, the New Silk Road, you know, all these new arrangements that are being made. If you look at Turkey, looking at this new Megillah, whether you call it a new prosperity zone or the center of the world economy, as it may come to be known, may well be known as that now, you're talking about, a third anyway, maybe almost half of the world's surface. Mm-hmm. Two-thirds, if you have India integrated into this, which is problematic, but just a natural, and you have two-thirds of the world's population, most of the productive capacity, or a large portion of the productive capacity, and Turkey is at its focal point with Europe. And if you look at the scale of even a thoroughly integrated European Union, even drawing mm-hmm. on what colonies those countries still have available to them, mm-hmm. it pales mm-hmm. next to this behemoth that's rising. Yeah. And so Turkey is yes. the point of contact.
In a lot of ways, yes, you're right.
And let me just say also, measure that against the fact that they're only... You know, the only hope that's ever held out to them is to be a peripheral player in the EU.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And now other options are opening up to Turkey. And that, in a lot of ways, explains this alliance between Turkey, Russia, and Iran to control the peace process in Syria. I mean, the United States is not included in it. I mean, and this pattern of the exclusion of the United States, for example, in the new free trade zone proposed by China after the collapse of the TPP,
right.
includes right. most of the nations of Asia and Pacific except the United States.
Right.
I mean, and this is a pattern of the isolation of the United States, what we might call a global counter-hegemonic alliances being forged at this moment. And, of course, the 2016 elections are a reflection of new historical processes taking place at a time when these developments are going forward in the world. You know, and you know, this, I don't see how you can miss it. I just don't understand why intelligent people and informed people do not see this in the large terms that it must be seen in.
You know, I'm looking at the condition that exists with the U.S. being isolated like this. And it is really, you could call it a counter-hegemonic uprising.
Yes. You know, I would call it that.
Yeah.
And don't rule out the U.S. working class as a part of this process.
Exactly. That's where I was going. Because,
oh, yes.
And this election. No, because you mentioned the election, and I was going to tie those two things together. Go ahead and elaborate for sure. That was the point I wanted to make.
Yeah. First of all, I think, as we have said in our conversations over these past 9 or 10 months, that Trump, in contradictory ways, perhaps not completely consistent, represents a retreat from empire and U.S. hegemony. And, you know, I'm prepared to argue that. I know people would say, well, how can you be so optimistic given statements that he has made about China? But the statements that he has made about China are at best not consistent, but there is something that he keeps saying. He wants new trading and economic and financial relationships with China.
Right.
One of the things that he keeps saying, he wants to negotiate with major countries not based upon multilateral agreements, as we had with the TPP, but bilateral agreements. The Chinese are very pragmatic. The Chinese are very sophisticated. The Chinese have a plan, you know, for what they want to do in the next 50 years, yeah. By God.
Yeah, or 500 even.
Well, maybe that too, you know what I'm saying? But they have a plan. They have pretty much a stable leadership, and they are a part of the world, which is the center of the global economy.
Yeah, the productive economy.
That's right.
The center of global production.
Absolutely. And as goes Asia, so goes the world economy. Europe and the United States will be peripheral to that. No leader of the United, I won't say no, but at least Trump shows signs of being more rational than, for example, the Obamas and the Clintons and the McCains and others who see using the big stick, the war threat, to get the world back in line. Trump is saying something very different.
You know, one of the arguments that people make against this, you know, when people don't want to acknowledge or see it in these terms anyway, is that, look, it's advanced, it's late-stage capitalism in the United States. It's going to drive Clinton, it's going to drive Trump, it's going to drive everyone. Their aims haven't changed. There's going to be a war with somebody, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm wondering if there are some people in the elite here that might be identified, powers behind the throne, whatever, with Trump, that are looking at the possibility of following the dynamic that drives their self-interest, their economic interests as a subset of the class or the whole class, that, hey, there's this whole planet we can develop before we come mm-hmm. to this crisis, that this crisis is premature. And that if we look in an orderly fashion at developing the world, exploiting the world, if you will, this is much more sustainable. We can consume the whole planet and everybody in it before we face this crisis. So let's sit down and work out new relations among us, see the whole as one economy, and all of us as equal players with, you know, whatever tools we bring to the table as, you know, weight, and try to hash out some sort of a modus vivendi.
Mm-hmm.
What do you
mm-hmm.
think?
Yeah, I mean, that's rational, you know. That makes sense. But most of the elite are blinded by their narrow class, and I would add race interest.
And ideology.
And ideology, of course. Yeah. You know, look, Trump is a member of the elite, although not and has never been a strategic or major player.
Exactly.
He's a real estate developer. He is not a part of the financial oligarchy.
And he's a label like Christian Dior or whatever, you know.
Thank you. And politically, he is a rogue. He is something that is difficult to define within the two-party duopoly. He's a Democrat at times. He was a Republican in this election. He is a maverick, and he acts like a maverick. He thinks like a maverick. He wants to preserve his standing in the political framework of the United States as a maverick. He will try to govern as a maverick. In other words, he is challenging the fundamentals of the American-dominated world order.
Yeah.
Look, you know, life is not a textbook. History does not unfold like we read it in textbooks. If there are historical analogies, it is not to be found in the history books. Clearly, the constant attempt to analogize this moment in America's history and the unraveling of the political system with Germany in 1930 is nonsense.
Yeah, this is a different change. This is an epical change. You might go back instead to look at the crisis of feudalism or the crisis of the plantation system or whatever.
Yes.
You know, those are the periods that are historical analogies. If you're a Marxist, then believe that the economic is the primary motivator.
Listen, I agree with you completely, but why are so many intellectuals looking backward rather than forward? Because they are afraid to conceive of a world, first of all, of struggle, of unraveling of the world system.
Yeah,
let's
messy.
Be honest with ourselves.
Very messy.
Most intellectuals and most activists have become comfortable with the world as it has been, and they cannot conceive of a world that is fundamentally different from what has been. And so they hold on to this past and claim that anything that is not consistent with that is a threat to all of democracy, to world peace, and everything else. And I agree with you. I think we're on the doorstep of a change of epochs. And it's not going to be the one great revolutionary act. In fact, it might be a decades-long decline of the West, especially of the United States. It might turn into a class and civil conflict in many developed capitalist countries. You know, by the way, that's what many of the writers in the Financial Times openly talk about. A long period of conflict and economic stagnation and conditions that look almost like class civil war. That's not out of the question in Europe in particular and in the United States. At the same time, the world moves forward. The Chinese and Russians develop more of their alliance. More countries in Asia reject U.S. hegemony. Turkey moves to the east. You know, it's hard to say how all of this will play out in South America and in Africa. But the weakening of the U.S. empire, of the dollar, of the U.S. military domination of the world opens up all kinds of new possibilities for the freeing of the world and of humanity from Western domination.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.